KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Soma in San Francisco.
Elmwood.
El Sobrano.
Do you live in Richmond?
Yeah.
Coming up, how a group of Bay Area parents built a community for young adults with autism.
For some people, purpose involves paid employment, and for some people, purpose involves giving back to the community.
Then the verdict in the Kate Steinle case revives debate about border security and illegal immigration.
Trump referred to Steinle as beautiful Kate and used her death as an example of the dangers of illegal immigration and why he wanted a wall to be built at the border.
And we hear from a choreographer on the nuances of making political art.
Is the performance itself trying to change the world? And then I would say maybe instead of yes.
That's all coming up on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Over the next decade, it's estimated that between 500,000 and 1 million children with autism will age into adulthood in the U.S. Some advocates describe it as a wave that's only now beginning to hit shore. And they say when it comes to giving these people independent lives, we're not prepared. Nearly 90% of young adults with autism live with their families at some point. That's almost all of them, and two-thirds are unemployed. One group of Bay Area parents, though, started preparing for different outcomes back in 2009. They created a co-housing development in Sonoma for adults with autism. We sent KALW's Jesse Rhodes to find out more.
When Gwen Fisher went to college, she left Cupertino, California, and moved into the dorms at the University of Iowa.
I went, like, not cross-country, but halfway, which is, like, the Midwest. And so that was freaky.
Gwen was diagnosed with autism at the age of 7. She gave college a try, but the culture of football, being away from home, and the cramped quarters eventually got to her. She often felt misunderstood and lonely.
I had enough. After 2 years, I'm like, I want to go back to California. I'm like, and plus I was having my own, I'm not going to say specifically personal issues myself, so I was kind of ready to head out.
Gwen moved back in with her folks, joining the almost 90% of young adults with autism who live with their parents at some point. And like two-thirds of young adults with autism, Gwen was unemployed. It felt like a step backwards. And then her parents discovered Sweetwater Spectrum, a co-housing community for adults with autism. It was not love at first sight.
To be honest, I just didn't think it was the right fit at first. But then the director, she called and said that there's this person, this young lady that I think you would like to meet and, you know, you would do well with. And so we drove up here on, I think it was a farm night. This was 3 years ago. And we ended up clicking. So then that's when I decided to move up here.
Gwen moved into one of the houses. In fact, the same house as her new friend.
I'm Tamsin, and I've been living at Sweetwater for 3.5 years.
That's Tamsin Kearns, the friend that convinced Gwen to join Sweetwater.
There's people here, residents here, that have 24-hour care. There's help residents that need help with, like, hygiene, help taking their medication, help with cooking and stuff. And then the more higher functioning are people that just need help with, like, anxiety management, taking the doctor's appointments. But yes, there is a spectrum here.
And as you can hear, Tamsin is an outspoken advocate for her community. So what is it about Sweetwater that Tamsin loves? Part of it is Sweetwater's architecture, which was designed with autism in mind.
Marsha was the, I think you're the lead architect behind Sweetwater. So she's up for a visit from
Beautiful
San Francisco.
Thank you.
The lead architect, Marsha Matem, and Sweetwater's director, Corey Stradinger, took me on a tour to see the buildings, which were largely designed to minimize sensory overload. The insulation in the ceilings absorbs sounds, non-vinyl flooring reduces synthetic smells, natural ceiling ventilation keeps rooms cool, without the shadow patterns or downbearing air from a ceiling fan.
There's a range of issues that needed to be dealt with in terms of light and pattern and color, even things like odor and sound.
But in speaking with residents like Gwen and Tamsin, the thing that makes Sweetwater such a success is
choice, because I visited a few group homes. I was in a group home myself. Here it's like you have the potlucks, there's like splash time on Fridays, there's a farm stand, there's a lot of activities, but they're not mandatory. You're not like, oh, you have to do this thing, you have to do that.
For Tamsin, that means volunteering at a local elementary school. For Gwen, that means volunteering at a no-kill shelter, even though she's allergic to cats. And for some residents, that even means paid work.
Yeah. So look at this. We've got the farm stand thriving.
Hi. I met you last time at the potluck. How's it going?
Good.
On a Tuesday morning, a couple of residents and their support staff have decided to join the farm stand at Sweetwater's entrance, selling produce that was grown on the premises. I spot Tamsin and say hello.
How's business today?
Good. It seems to be picking up compared to past weeks.
Oh, really?
So if the key to a happy life is opportunity and choice, then I wanted to understand how Sweetwater made it happen.
I really...
That's Carolyn Klebanoff, one of the founders of Sweetwater.
So when we're referring to Sweetwater Spectrum, we do not use the word facility. We call that our F word. And that is because facility connotes institutional living. And this is anything but institutional living.
In addition to being Sweetwater's co-founder, Carolyn is also the parent of an adult with autism.
She was diagnosed at the age of 2. She's fairly significantly impacted and so had a lot of support through her school age years. And at some point when she was about 13, we started thinking about what her adulthood would look like.
Carolyn tells me that every year in California, 5,000 individuals with autism age into adulthood. She reiterates the stats about how many of those people are living at home and unemployed, which, for her, points to how unprepared we are to provide opportunities for adults with autism.
There hadn't been a lot of forethought, and really still hasn't been a lot of forethought, as to what happens to these individuals when they finish their school age years. So that's how we started thinking about founding something, because there wasn't anything out there that looked like it would work for her.
Carolyn met with other families in the Bay Area, and together, they began to brainstorm a solution. They ran focus groups in Marin and Sonoma County, they spoke with local experts, and they traveled the country looking at what already existed. The guiding principle that emerged from that research, which is scrawled in big letters over the doorway in the community center, is life with purpose.
When we were running our focus groups to try and figure out what was important to people out there before we designed this model, it was so apparent that loneliness is a huge issue for many, many individuals with disabilities.
For Carolyn, the solution to loneliness isn't just getting a bunch of people in a room, although she'll admit that's important. It's making sure everyone has a sense of purpose.
For some people, purpose involves paid employment, and for some people, purpose involves giving back to the community, and for some people, purpose involves just simply being able to control your own environment outside of your parental home.
Carolyn is quick to point out, as you might be thinking, that this applies to everyone. But when you consider that 2/3 of young adults with autism are unemployed, the idea of a life with purpose becomes crucial.
And so we have to support them in both defining what purpose means and then trying to achieve it. And that's part of what the Sweetwater staff manages to do, to mine opportunities in the local community for people who are looking for meaningful activities.
Since Sweetwater opened its doors, it's housed 16 residents and seems to have been a success for most of them. Only 2 have left. In addition to the farm stand and volunteer jobs, there are potluck nights, classes, and weekly outings the residents can take part in. But after 3 visits to the campus, I get the sense that the ability to replicate this model may be limited. According to Carolyn, a cost of living here is nearly $3,000 a month.
The state of California does not pay the rent for Sweetwater. The individuals or their families do. And we have 2 aspects to our rent. One is the actual rent, and the other is a community fee, think condo fee, for the general facility. I used my F word.
The F word.
For the Sweetwater staff and the property maintenance.
Sweetwater was well-funded by private donations. And although nearly 1/3 of the residents get financial assistance, that couldn't happen without the 2/3 of families who can afford the full expense.
So at the moment, it would be a real struggle to develop something like Sweetwater without knowing where your funding's coming from.
Carolyn knows the limits of relying on private donations. She dreams of a future where supportive living communities can be financed by the government and accessed by anyone, regardless of their financial status. Having a prototype for what that could look like, though, gives Carolyn hope. Already, there is a Sweetwater South planned in Los Angeles. Carolyn is organizing to build another in the Bay Area.
Well, the future looks happy for the people who live here, which is such a great thing. And this is designed to be their forever home. They hopefully will continue to be happy and age in place. So, how great is that?
As for Tamsin, she'll continue her volunteer work at a nearby elementary school. Gwen is returning to school at a local junior college this fall.
I used to be so nervous whenever I went back to school, and I'm kind of excited. It's kind of a relief. I'm like, yeah, yeah. Go back to school and hopefully, you know, meet new people and get my stuff together.
Gwen says she wants to study to become a veterinarian, even though she's allergic to cats. For Cross Currents, I'm Jesse Rhodes.
Find more information about Sweetwater Spectrum at our website, klw.org, and click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. A San Francisco jury found Jose Inez Garcia Zarate not guilty of murder in the death of Kate Steinle last week. Since then, President Donald Trump has renewed calls to build a wall on the border. Attorney General Jeff Sessions has sharpened his criticism of sanctuary cities. Inside that courtroom, though, the jury was asked to ignore the fierce debate about immigration enforcement that this case kicked off. For more on this, joining me now is KALW's justice reporter, Holly J. McDeed.
So, you know, before we talk about the trial, let's talk about some of the facts of the case. What happened?
Well, so back in July of 2015, Kate Steinle, a 32-year-old woman from Pleasanton, was shot and killed while walking with her dad on Pier 14 in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Jose Inez Garcia Zarate, an undocumented homeless immigrant from Mexico, admitted to firing the bullet that killed her. After this tragedy, people started thinking harder about border enforcement. Garcia Zarate had previously been deported 5 times. And people also had questions about San Francisco's sanctuary city policies. Mm-hmm. Because Garcia Zarate had been charged with selling marijuana 20 years earlier. He ended up in San Francisco, but because the city is a sanctuary city, the sheriff's department didn't honor ICE's request to detain him once the charges were dropped.
Right.
Steinle was shot and killed just 2 weeks after Donald Trump announced that he was running for president. On the campaign stump, Trump referred to Steinle as beautiful Kate and used her death as an example of the dangers of illegal immigration and why he wanted a wall to be built at the border.
Okay, so then bring us up to speed. What happened last week in court?
So the jury found Garcia Zarate not guilty of first-degree murder, second-degree murder, and involuntary manslaughter. They did find him guilty of possessing a firearm, which he wasn't supposed to do because he's a convicted felon.
Okay, so the jury had 3 choices. They chose none of them. So what next?
Well, the question to the jury was not whether Garcia Zarate killed Steinle, but whether it was intentional or an accident. Inside the courtroom, the defense argued the gun accidentally discharged and the bullet ricocheted off the pavement and traveled another 78 feet before hitting Steinle. But remember, this was a gun that was found after it had been stolen from a federal ranger's car. So prosecutors argued it's the type of gun law enforcement uses precisely because it's hard to have that kind of gun just fire accidentally.
Uh-huh.
In the end, the jury sided with the defense's argument. The defendant found a gun wrapped under his seat at the pier, and the gun accidentally went off.
Okay, but what about the involuntary manslaughter charge? Even if Garcia Zarate never intended to shoot someone, couldn't he be charged with accidentally causing Steinle's death?
Well, there are actually two types of involuntary manslaughter. There's one that's just an accidental killing, and that one is a misdemeanor. But in this case, prosecutors charged Garcia Zarate with a felony involuntary manslaughter, meaning that they're trying to prove that he brandished the weapon in a rude, threatening, or angry manner.
Uh-huh.
Those were the judge's words in the jury instructions. And in the end, the jury was not convinced there was criminal intent.
Okay, so what are some of the reactions then to that?
Well, many legal experts say the prosecutors overreached here and gave the jury too many options and diluted their own case.
Mm-hmm.
For example, prosecutors argued in their opening statement for second-degree murder, then later argued for first-degree murder as the trial went on. Others on social media have their own theories about what they see as a blindly liberal-minded San Francisco jury. After the verdict, thousands tweeted hashtag boycott San Francisco. One man even called the city a used needle-strewn hipster dystopia. Some users speculated the verdict shows that San Francisco residents don't understand how guns work.
Mm.
Donald Trump weighed in. He's outraged that the jurors were asked not to consider the defendant's immigration status.
Right.
He said that jurors should have been allowed to consider Garcia Zarate's criminal history of crossing the border.
Okay, so what happens now?
So the defense is planning to appeal the sole gun possession conviction. If they don't manage that, he's looking at up to 3 years in jail, but he's already served more than 2 years while awaiting his sentence.
Mm-hmm.
However, earlier this week, a federal grand jury indicted Garcia Zarate on new immigration and gun charges. So he could face 10 years in jail if convicted there.
So what about the Steinle family? What have they said after this verdict?
So the Steinle family gave what they said will be their final interview to the San Francisco Chronicle. Kate's brother, Brad Steinle, said the trial doesn't change the fact that the system on the city and federal level didn't protect his sister.
Mm.
The father, Jim Steinle, says he wants to be able to move on with his life and think about Kate on his own terms. He says nothing about Kate's death has ever been on his terms because of how politicized the tragedy has become. And it's true, it has been politicized. A white nationalist group actually set up a memorial for Kate Steinle near where she was shot soon after the verdict.
Mm-hmm.
Immigration authorities say that if and when Garcia Zarate gets out of jail, he'll be deported again.
Mm-hmm.
But that's probably not going to satisfy the president. President Trump has already said that he plans to make Kate's death a campaign issue in 2020.
Holly J. McDeed is KALW's justice reporter. If you've got a story you'd like to see her report, email her at justice@kalw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Keeping up with the daily news cycle can sometimes be stressful. We brace ourselves for partisan political strife, new revelations of abuse or harassment, or events of public mass violence. While some of us may take refuge in trash TV or a hot bath, San Francisco-based choreographer and performance artist Keith Hennessy likes to process through making art. His new solo show is called Sync, and he says the title is partly about throwing all of his thoughts and feelings about the current state of the world into the performance, everything but the kitchen sink. He told KALW's Jen Sheehan about the process of making the show, which is a combination of dance, music, theater, and imagery.
So you have been working on this material that goes into this solo piece for a long time. You told me that you started working on some of it at least 2 years ago.
Yeah. There's a song that I sing in the piece that I started writing after Orlando. So that was...
After the shooting in Orlando.
After the shooting in Orlando at this queer club that was primarily Latinx. And until Vegas, it was the biggest mass shooting in modern U.S. history.
And you sing it in the show, Sync.
Yes, I do.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that song. It's pretty long in its entirety, but maybe we can hear a
long
little excerpt of it.
Yeah, I'll do just the beginning part. Mm-hmm.
pick up a gun. Why pick up a gun? You can't defend anyone. You can't defend anyone. I was concerned not just how do we, not just how to remember something, but how do we even have feelings about it? Like, there's almost a pressure with each event, each crisis, to think that it belongs to certain people and it's somewhere else. And we're all waiting for our moment, and we build our relationships to things. Like, my brother was visiting the World Trade Center only the week before it was, you know, crashed into with airplanes and dropped to the ground, you know. So we find these ways to build these lines, but we don't have any ongoing way to process or to integrate our feelings or to even have feelings, I think. And I think that there's a sort of false paralleling that happens between all of these crazy events. Somehow these things all smash into each other, and then we just have to go back to work and or pick up a kid from school or figure out which supplement we need to feel healthy, you know, whatever we're doing. So the song is really just a moment to take time to think through that.
Can you give folks a sense of what else might be in the show? You played us a song, but what are some of the other sections that might go in it?
There are two dances after the song. One of them is on very unusual stilts. They're metal stilts and they're curved, so they're made for bouncing. And so imagine now that I'm in this small dance studio theater, and really two or three jumps and you're across the room. So it's very much about this contained dance. So there's a dance on stilts, and then the closing dance of the piece is an aerial dance. I have this whole installation of these hanging straps and loops, and I very quietly, non-spectacularly climb up them and come down them. And there's a sense of floating, sinking, drifting.
So you talked about your personal feelings about these global events. Can you say a little bit more about how you think of using art as the response mechanism? I know you're also very politically aware and politically active.
Yeah, with this work, I've been thinking it's worth it to distinguish activist art or political art from art that is motivated by politics.
Say more.
Right. So is the performance itself trying to change the world? And then I would say maybe instead of yes. Part of that is that I'm thinking that the central, in some ways, the performance is like a highly edited journal entry from the last 2 years. So I'm taking artistic practices that I have of the ways that I observe the world, the way that I observe my body and my thinking and my feelings, and I'm making an expressionistic painting, for example, except that it's coming out through songs, dances, poetic texts.
You spoke about this new solo being a kind of healing or a way for you to process some of the trauma that you've been experiencing from just bad news and bad things happening in the world. And I wonder, and I don't mean to ask this in a disrespectful way, but what do you think is the value of you personally processing that for an audience? And how might that help other people process what they're also experiencing, the same things that you are?
Yeah, I think this is a great question. I think it's one of the big questions people are asking white and white male artists in particular right now.
Of which you are, for radio audiences
for those people who can't see me. Really there, I'm coming back. I'm trying to be quite humble with it. I'm not insisting that everyone come to the show. I'm making it as cheap as possible. I'm making it quite low key. And then I'm resting on a certain kind of history that I have with art, which is being moved by poetic live performance, and that somehow it helps me. It gives me some kind of restoration. It helps me stay on certain kinds of tracks. It helps me avoid other kinds of tracks.
What kind of tracks?
I think a track that I flirt with is the despair track, for example. And when I'm seeing a song that really works for me, it could be a dance. It could be some live theater performance experience. But somehow when things work in a particular way, I leave and it's like I'm a little bit more comfortable in the world. I understand my own job differently. So, yeah, what's the role of art and how do we justify it? That question gets asked out loud right in the piece. But I think what I'm coming back to is that it's kind of the journal entry slash painting that I've been working on for the last couple of years. And I'm going to see if it's necessary in the world. Does anyone else need it besides me and the 30 or 40 people who will see it each night? I'm not expecting it to be big audiences.
Maybe so. More after they hear you talk about it.
Yes, who knows, now that it's here. It'll be 62 people a night.
That was Keith Hennessy speaking with KLW's Jen Chien about his new solo show called Sync. You can catch it at the Joe Good Annex on Friday and Saturday. All that information is at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. Today's local music is by the San Francisco Girls Chorus. Their holiday concert is called Greetings from All Seasons. The San Francisco Girls Chorus sings Monday at Davies Symphony Hall in San Francisco. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.